I try to overwhelm my instinct, which is I'm a hater at heart, and you know I'm a critic. It's fun to talk shit.
And it's easy to talk shit in this EV market.
100%.
Hello and welcome back to the Plugged In Podcast, a weekly news show from Inside EVs all about the future of transportation. I'm Mac Hogan, editor-in-chief of Inside EVs.
And I'm Tim Levin. Okay, I'm just joking. I'm Suvrat Kothari covering for Tim today. I know I pulled this joke off for you a couple of weeks ago. Yeah.
Welcome back. Good to have you as always. We have not hosted
Thank
together.
You.
We've both co-hosted with Tim. So it's
this is our first co-host, yes.
This episode of the Plugged In Podcast by Inside EVs is presented by Hankook Tire.
Hey everyone, it's me, Olivia, at Demo Days 2026 in Los Angeles, California. In addition to our booth, we've actually got a ride and drive portion where you guys can come and test out our tires for yourselves. Thank you guys for joining us here at the Hankook booth at Demo Days LA. We'll see you next time.
Yeah. So on today's episode, we're going to talk about a new fast charging pricing war that I am hoping to see develop. It's led by Ayana and Walmart, which are rapidly expanding their EV charging ambitions. We're also going to talk about a new LG Energy Systems battery factory that you had a chance to take a look at this week, and one trick to save money while AC charging your EV. So let's jump into this with the DC fast charging price war news. Now,
let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. This all came from a conversation I had with Lauren McDonald of Chargenomics. He had done some analysis of Perrin charging data. And one of the things he called out to me that I thought was really worth talking about was that Ayana and Walmart are two of these very rapidly growing, you know, EV charging behemoths. Ayana, a conglomeration of eight automakers, funded this to try to just solve the charging problem, right? So the goal is to have 30,000 EV fast charging plugs by 2030. And then Walmart, you know, they already had a successful partnership with Electrify America. They realized it was bringing people into the stores. So now they're rapidly building up their own system with 400 kilowatt chargers. Like Ayana, they're doing NACS and CCS connectors. So two companies that are trying to challenge sort of what Lauren mentioned as the big three, right? Which is Electrify America, EVgo, and Tesla superchargers. And a key part of what they're doing is they are really undercutting them on price. Now, Electrify America and Tesla both charge on average, based on this data, about 56 cents a kilowatt hour, whereas Ayana is charging around 37 cents, and then Walmart is 43 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's pretty cheap. I mean, Suvrat, what have you noticed about EV charging prices in your area and different
That you know, sounds providers? About right to me, because I've spent an unholy amount of money at charging at Electrify America and Tesla superchargers.
Yeah.
In the Northeast, I mean, I live in New York City. All the superchargers and public fast charging stations in this area are very, very expensive. I've paid like 70 cents a kilowatt hour, 65 cents. That's probably what I've been paying for the past couple years with all the press cars that I get. Now Walmart and Ayana, which are these burgeoning EV charging networks, sort of trying to challenge the incumbents, and pricing is one of their weapons, I guess.
Yeah, and I think EV charging prices are weird because I don't think people have a really good understanding of what the numbers mean. It's just like cents per kilowatt hour is just not something I think that is fully broken through to people. I did some light math in the story to talk about what these numbers correspond to. So 56 cents a kilowatt hour in like my car, Chevy Blazer EV all-wheel drive, there is a direct gas equivalent to that car. And if you get the four-cylinder one with all-wheel drive and you're paying the national average price for gas, at 56 cents a kilowatt hour, you're like a little bit ahead in the EV, but not much.
Yeah.
65, 70, these are like numbers that are screw you numbers, in my opinion, right?
Yes.
So, like, there's a Tesla supercharger near me that charges 74 cents a kilowatt hour.
Oh, my God.
Which that's ludicrous. Yeah. And
if you're charging a big battery EV, like, on that station, it's going to be really bad. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've had, I think, I don't remember if it was Patrick or Kevin that got a huge charging bill for a Silverado EV.
Right.
It's not free. And I think for a couple years, everyone was getting 2 years free or a certain number of charging credits. And I have people who still tell me they thought EV fast chargers were free. And I'm like, boy, I wish they were, because it costs a lot of money. And I think a huge part of that that I get into in the story is so much of the competition has just been who has the most stations and where are they?
Yeah.
And so obviously Tesla has a huge lead. They're still installing more than anyone else. And they were competing on, they had a captive audience, which Tesla drivers get a cheaper rate than me when I go to a Tesla, you know, supercharger, unless I pay a monthly subscription. But yeah, they were competing based on location, and EVgo and Electrify America were right there. And now it feels like we're finally getting to the point where you see places where there are multiple fast charging locations right around each other. And then you actually see some price pressure, which I think is pretty important.
Which is super interesting. Can we go a little bit into the detail about how Iona and Walmart exactly are pricing? What are their approaches? And what do you get? How is it different from charging at a Tesla supercharger? Is the experience better or worse?
Yeah, you've charged at an Iona station, right? I have not, because of the...
Oh, you've
not?
Think, okay.
No. But famously, these two companies are doing different approaches, right? Why don't you talk a little bit about what you experienced at Iona and how that relates to their overall strategy?
I have charged a bunch at those stations, especially at the Sheetz and Wawa gas stations.
Okay.
So Iona partners with these bigger gas station chains to install their public fast charging stations at these locations, which are usually like extremely well located. They have amenities. Yeah. You have restaurants, cafes. You have trash cans at these stalls. They have canopies, bathrooms. Yeah, Wi-Fi, and some of the Iona flagship stations also have like driver lounges where you can relax in air conditioning while your EV charges up. I definitely remember paying in the 30 cents. Per kilowatt hour range at these Iona stalls. I've never had an issue. One big beef I have with Iona stations in this area is parking is for all vehicles. At a lot of these Wawa and Cheat stations, which is super unusual, they literally have a board which says all vehicles are welcome to park. Which
so
I don't
even
know why
in the charging stalls?
Even on the charging stalls, which is super weird. It's not like, okay, these are like super low traffic stations as of yet. They're not as busy as Tesla superchargers, so maybe they don't want to scare drivers away in case their regular charging spots are fully filled. But when it comes to pricing, it's definitely cheaper.
I wonder how much of that is like Sheetz being like, we don't want a gas customer who wants to just fill up, come inside and get a soda or something. We don't want to ever scare anyone away that they're not allowed to park somewhere. But it's definitely a different approach.
That could be it. That could be it, yeah. But pricing-wise, my other big problem is the ubiquity of Tesla superchargers is just undeniable. Like, I have at least two in my neighborhood. I don't have to drive far at all, while I have to drive like 50 miles for the Iona station. So am I going to do that just because it's like 37 cents per kilowatt hour, or just pay a little bit more and just charge in my neighborhood?
Yeah, but I would say one of the things that Iona is doing that I think is important, although I'm not saying this overwhelms the advantage of a supercharger or anything like that, but you can pay with a credit card. You can just show up. You don't have to deal with the app stuff, which is a huge deal.
It is super
Walmart
easy.
Did not do that at first, and very quickly were like, actually, we're going to do that. People hate this. But I think it's interesting how they're different businesses, and that Iona really exists for its own purpose to build the charging network so that these companies that want to sell EVs don't have to keep telling customers like, no, there's like, you can use these other, you know, random patchwork networks. Like, they want to have one network that covers everyone and they want the experience to be good. So they are very often located with amenities, bathrooms, stores, but the stores are usually things like a Sheetz, like a Wawa, where the store is run by a different company. So Iona captures the business of the EV driver and then offloads that customer into a store that they don't own or manage. Walmart is doing a different thing, right? Where Walmart already has the stores. It already has bathrooms. It has fresh food options. There's literally nothing you need to survive that you could not get inside of Walmart. And they do not I don't think they're worried about parking at all. I've never seen a huge Walmart parking lot. Have you ever seen one with fewer than 100 open spaces at any given
time? I've seen so many Walmart parking lots with donut marks on them. They're like literally so empty.
Until recently, you were allowed to camp overnight there anytime you wanted. I don't think that that's still true. But anyway, they already have sort of the infrastructure of it. They also have the nationwide scale there's thousands of Walmart stores, so they can really compete for prices on components. They can negotiate well with utilities, but also they don't need to make money on the charging. Like Ayana doesn't need to make money because Ayana doesn't really exist to make money. Yeah. Walmart doesn't need to make money on the charging because they're betting that you're going to go in the store. And based on the fact that they're so aggressively investing in this after those EA stations, which I've used before, and I often target EAs in Walmart parking lots because I know there's a bathroom and I know there's food options. But I think Walmart is saying like, okay, let's bring people in. Let's get them into our stores that especially, are they the same customers that normally would come to a Walmart? Like I'm very rarely going to a Walmart if I'm not charging an EV, but I've gone a lot more since I started charging EVs there, right? And a key part of their strategy is also they have cheaper prices if you're part of Walmart Plus. So we get you to come in for the short delivery timelines and the cheaper prices and streaming deals, whatever the hell. Bundle it all in, come into our ecosystem, live here, which I think is why they're undercutting
everyone. Do everything at Walmart. Do the shopping, the EV charging. That's one of their big USPs for sure. And the other thing I want to mention is Walmart is also very omnipresent. According to Walmart, more than 90% of its stores, I'm sorry, more than 90% of the US population lives close by to a Walmart supercenter, which is, again, if they expand their charging network, they could also plug in some of these charging deserts we have in the US right now so that more people have access to these public DC fast charging stations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's interesting. Fast charging is always going to cost more than level two, or at least it should, in that you need an expensive high output AC to DC converter to take the power that's coming from the power lines, get it into your battery. Doing that quickly costs a lot of money and it increases what's called demand charges, where the utility contracts are usually structured in a way that you get charged for sort of the amount of bandwidth, for lack of a better term, like the amount of electricity pull you're going to pull at your peak moment. So that moment when all of those chargers are ripping and it's, 5 p.m. on a Friday and everyone's like juicing up for the weekend or something. When you pull that much power from the utility says, hey, you need to pay us extra for your rate in order for us to continue offering you this much service. And that's where fast chargers get hammered. So there's things that are going to drive that down, like solar arrays. Tesla's doing this a lot. Battery backups, restructuring those contracts. Some places don't have contracts like that. There are things that can drive this down, but I think the number one thing that's going to keep driving it down is like, why is Tesla going to invest in that? Because they need to be price competitive. And I think the more healthy players we have, the more we're just going to see that expand it. And I don't think we're going to be paying this much for EV fast charging in the long term, I would hope.
I would hope that too, but I think it's good that we have more players sort of competing for the best price. It's a sign of the EV charging industry sort of becoming more mature and more healthy. Yeah. How sustainable is it for Ayana and Walmart to sort of undercut Tesla on pricing? I don't know that yet. We'll find out. I think broadly this is a good direction that we're heading into.
Yeah, I mean, notably the companies that. Again, let's pull out Tesla for a moment because they're so large and they have such an incumbency advantage. When you look at all these other countries, like they're not making money usually off the charging. Part of that is it's extremely expensive to scale and then it's cheaper to maintain that scale, right? But right now they're spending a ton of money building. So that's going to be expensive for a long time. Ultimately, more level two will also decrease the overall demand on these, ideally on the networks, which then would lower the demand charges, although even right now there's utilization issues. So it's not clear where it's going. The cheapest way is always going to be AC charging your car.
Right.
But I don't think that I think we're going to see a lot more competition on price and also on experience, right? Ayana and Walmart are offering a different product than Tesla, which is like Tesla is selling charging. They're not really doing anything experiential besides the diner, which is working, interestingly enough. But, you know, Mercedes-Benz high power charging is trying to sell a little bit more of an upscale experience. There's concepts like Rove. There's going to be a lot of innovation here. And it feels like at the core of that, though, you need the big players that have the resources to compete with each other. And I think it's good that that's going to be five companies rather than three.
I think I want to highlight one of the quotes a Volvo executive made at one of the press events I attended earlier this year in New York. Mm-hmm. There was at the EX60 reveal in New York. Mm-hmm. So according to Volvo, people are now overspending at fast charging stations. That's because a lot of these new EVs absolutely rip. They're charging at like 350, 400 kilowatts. And that means you don't need long charging stops at all. You can just charge for a few minutes and get back on the road. But that's not what people are doing because they're simply not used to it yet. So you pull up to a fast charging station in one of your ultra fast charging new EVs. Instead of doing a 10-minute charge, you end up doing a 25-minute charge because you're out getting a coffee, you're out grabbing a snack, going to the restroom. And by the time you're back, you've spent more on the charging itself, and you've also spent more on amenities. So I don't want to overstate something that one company is claiming is happening, but I think with education, as people become more aware of how much they want to spend on a charging, how long their charging stop needs to be, I think we'll have a better sort of broader understanding of what people exactly want and how much they're willing to pay for
public charging stop. This is something I didn't get into in the story, but it's something me and Lauren talked about a while of just right-sizing the speed and facilities of all these chargers. I pointed out there's an awesome 350 kilowatt, 20 stall Electrify America charger near me. Super reliable new gen equipment, but it's at the mall and you don't spend 30 minutes at the mall. You spend a couple hours at the mall. And so, or the other day I went out hiking and I was coming back, and on the way back, my favorite lunch stop has a supercharger right there, and it's great, except like my car didn't need an hour on the charger, it needed like 20 minutes on the charger, so I had to get up and move it, and all of those things need to be worked out. But it seems like we're well on the way, and the days of just like, here's four chargers in the back of a parking lot, and by the way, two of them are broken, that feels completely gone to me. Good riddance.
Absolutely. I've not seen a broken Electrify America or EVgo charger in the past 8 months. Last year, I definitely encountered a few, but this year it's been like, it seemed like it's improved quite a bit. On the chargers in shopping mall thing, I went to the American Dream Mall in New Jersey last year, and it had a huge Tesla supercharger. And I felt the same thing that you did. Like, why are these cars charging here? Like, people are not going to... Level 2 chargers would make a lot of sense at these shopping malls, but we don't need huge DC fast charging lots.
For sure. Now, part of that story, as I said, to drive down costs is eventually going to be battery storage.
Yeah.
That's a huge burgeoning industry. You sort of went into one of the epicenters of that this week when you visited a cool battery factory in Michigan. What's the big news here? You know, tell me about what's going on.
So the big news is Korean battery giant LG Energy Solution, which is one of the world's top battery makers. They supply to Tesla, Toyota, Hyundai, bunch of other car makers. So they opened a brand new battery plant in Lansing, Michigan, which is just about an hour northwest of Detroit. I'll share some facts about this plant, and maybe then we can dive into what I actually saw and experienced during the factory tour.
Cool.
So the plant will make energy storage lithium iron phosphate LFP batteries for Tesla. Tesla is their main customers, but they're also making them for several other like utility companies and AI data centers and whatnot.
And again, the Tesla home energy side of it, right? These are not going into Tesla vehicles.
These are not going into Tesla vehicles. Correct. These are going into the Megapacks and the Powerwalls.
Yeah.
So they'll be made in both in prismatic and pouch form factors. So prismatic is basically a rectangular box. Pouch is a little bit thinner. And it will also make EV batteries for Toyota, starting with the three-row Highlander.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, these batteries will also go into the Subaru Getaway and the Lexus TZ.
Right.
And other brands and other models in the future. And just like my very first impressions were like, there was a huge factory. I was not expecting to see such a big plant. It was like half a mile in length and a quarter mile in width. It's like 2.8 million square feet of floor space and like 226 acre campus.
It's
like
hard to
numbers.
Even picture that.
I cannot. They have a bunch of drone shots and the drone is only capturing like half of the plant,
Factory photos are always so brutal because they're zoomed out so far. And it's like, if you squint really closely, you can see it's this tall and it's this wide.
It was huge. And they're promising some big numbers in terms of like jobs. They have about 900 employees right now. But at full capacity, it's going to be like 1,700 new jobs. And this was actually the original Ultium Sense joint venture with General Motors, which then GM backed out of because of lower EV demand and when the tax credit was ended last year. And then LG took full ownership of the plant. And now LG...
That's interesting you bring that up just because it was only last week that there was a similar plant, I believe it's in Indiana, that Samsung and...
Right.
GM we're going to do together.
Right.
And now GM is backing out of that and saying, well, we might buy supply from you in the future, but for now, that factory is going to focus on battery storage systems,
battery storage.
Home energy. Yeah, that's where all of this spare capacity is going.
You're right. And that's a broader pattern happening across the industry in the US. Ford and SK had a joint venture, which they sort of dissolved. Now, they had like two plants. Now, one plant is going to be owned by Ford and one plant is going to be owned by SK. They're both going to make ESS batteries. And LG does not have its EV business in the US. It's not profitable yet, but it's now expecting, thanks to ESS batteries, to have operating profit by the end of this year. So the demand for ESS batteries is absolutely skyrocketing. And that's happening a lot because of AI data centers. But in general, other than that, a lot of utility companies are sort of moving to energy storage systems to balance out the grid when the demand is, fluctuating.
Right. Now, solar with storage is cheaper than building more natural gas power plants, more fossil fuel power plants, which is like my favorite stat, right? I mean, that's the whole game, right? And so if we could balance this out with the right amount of batteries, and I also just love to see LFP production in the US, you know, just keep building up that supply chain because that's obviously important. The vast majority of LFP packs in America come from, or at least in EVs, come from China, because that's the dominant chemistry there, or at least one of the major ones. And just having more battery factories here, even if they're for energy storage systems. I mean, obviously plants like this are capable of switching. So eventually I would imagine there's going to be a lot of demand for the automotive packs here. But for now, if it takes ESS to keep the lights on, I say, you know, that's awesome.
That's absolutely true. And I did ask some of the senior LG executives about how much adaptability they have. What if we have a new president in 2028 and suddenly all the pro-EV policies are back? And so I'm quoting Bob Lee here, who is the North American president of LG. What he basically said was, yes, they're perfectly capable of adapting to demand, but it's not easy. Like you still need some equipment and retooling to convert ESS from EV to ESS.
Right.
So it's not easy. It's doable. But these companies have like LG is like it's a very old battery company. It knows it has a global footprint. It knows how to do this. And I was actually surprised that they gave us a very detailed tour of the battery plant. And man, it feels nothing like a traditional automotive plant. There are no clunking. Yeah, it's like there are no clunking metal noises. There's no moving assembly line. You don't see a lot of workers along the production line, like sort of putting parts on a chassis.
Yeah.
It's completely different. It's a lot quieter. There are still some noises, but it's mostly like those automated vehicles sort of transporting things around. They make those beeps and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, 1,700 jobs is obviously a lot of people, but for something that large, I was like, man, that doesn't seem... But yeah, I mean, it's these systems, especially on the battery side, tend to be super automated. And honestly, I mean, even modern car plants, it's surprising to me how quiet and clean everything is. Because, you know, like in your head, it's like a step above like a mechanics work yard or, you know, like there's just going to be people throwing stuff on. But now everything is so precise, so timed, quiet. I mean,
efficiency is the goal. So I guess that's where the industry is going.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else stick out from your trip there?
Yeah, so battery material, battery manufacturing is extremely like sensitive to contamination. So they made us go through the whole process, but we had to wear these yellow vests, and on top of that, we had to wear a full white gown, and then and then glasses, and then I changed my shoe covers like 3 times going from one side of the plant to the other side of the plant because they were like, we cannot have like the same shoe covers in 2 different parts of the facility.
Wow.
And then they were like, they put us in these rooms where like air blew at us at a very high speed, like
decontamination. I went through the same process when I went to a chip fab from Bosch. It's like automotive grade chip, so not super intense stuff, but yeah, going through like the clean rooms and stuff and having to like see that, and they use the pencils with specially designed graphite that doesn't break away and form microparticles. It's crazy.
Wow.
The level.
It's like incredibly granular levels of like focus on how to keep this plant like extremely clean.
I know. Do you ever feel, I sometimes feel almost embarrassed when I go to like a car factory or, you know, something like that, a chip fab, where we spend so much time talking about this from the outside of just like, they should just do this or just do this.
Yeah.
And then you remember how unbelievably complicated all of these processes actually, like, it's amazing you can make a car as reliable and precisely assembled as they do for the price they do, because it just doesn't, when you see it in action, it doesn't make any sense. Same, like even the batteries.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And one of the other things I wanted to mention here was the plant was incredibly high tech. Like, I just could not comprehend like how these machines were working and robots were working at such a high speed, assembling the cells with so much precision. And one of the things Bob Lee also said was a lot of the expertise is like US does not produce. I'm sorry, Bob Lee did not say this, but one of the other LG execs said that for traditional car manufacturing, a lot of the production is mechanical engineering driven.
Right.
But battery manufacturing is chemistry and material science driven. And the vast majority of these material science and electrochemistry engineers, they're getting groomed and trained in Asia. North America is not producing all these battery engineers, not yet. So there's definitely a delta for talent. A lot of it, and it's not
which
like
is a, I mean,
yeah,
it was not very long ago that it was, you know, North America was the center of these things, right?
Yeah.
Where, or at least the intellectual like side of it, and I mean, nobody, SK On, LG, like Panasonic, these are the companies that are driving it in even for our market, and then there's a million more in China that are doing it, and so even the quote unquote Western companies are primarily using a Korean or Japanese supply chain, and or at least intellectual property, knowledge, the companies themselves. And the American automakers, like, they're not really there. I mean, even their attempts to be there have been through these joint ventures, which they're now saying, all right, we actually don't want to own the factory. And LG and Samsung and the others are like, okay, great, we do, because this is going to keep growing.
You're right. And one of the reasons why legacy automakers have not done like gigawatt scale battery manufacturing is simply because like they don't have that expertise yet. Sure, they do have a lot of like R&D labs and small scale plants. Like GM has a small scale factory in Detroit, but a lot of its mass manufacturing is done by LG. And that's where these big battery companies come in, because they have these decades of experience. And they can churn out like gigawatt hours levels of energy systems at scale,
for sure,
across industries.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see how that supply chain grows and expands over time. I hope this is not the last bit of good news, because obviously the regulatory and incentive environment isn't there anymore. But the business case seems to be. So I hope these things keep expanding.
I hope so too. Yeah.
So. All right, we talked a little bit about batteries. Let's talk a little bit about charging those batteries, because this is the other big story I want to talk about this week. This is something Julian found that I thought was really interesting. It was about ADAC, the German, I think it's like a German equivalent to AAA. Basically did a study on the efficiency of slower AC charging. And I think we've talked a lot about how AC charging is cheaper generally than DC fast charging because you don't have to do that crazy conversion. But while the higher power version of DC versus AC, AC is cheaper, within the AC world, the faster you go, the cheaper it actually kind of works out to be. That's what this data says. So basically, they did tests at different power levels, and they don't directly correspond to US level one, level two, because this was European cars. But effectively, they did it around 2 kilowatts, then they did it around 11 kilowatts, and then for one of the cars, they were able to go even higher. Mm-hmm. And what they found is that this is something I have personal experience with, which I'll get to.
Yeah.
But effectively, the slower AC fast charging options were significantly less efficient than the faster ones. So in the worst case, if you were on a Mercedes CLA on 8-amp level one charging, which is an important distinction, so a low current level one charging, it saw basically, it lost 24.2% of the energy of charging. So if you buy 100 kilowatt hours from your electricity provider, you are only getting around 75 of those kilowatt hours. So you're paying 25% more for the same amount of charge, which is crazy.
A quarter drop is like big.
Yeah. And I mean, not big in the world of gas car efficiency. I'm just going to jump in here before any. Because again, a best case scenario is you're 30% efficient in a gas car, right? So this is still way more efficient, even when you factor in the drivetrain losses. If you were to do an 11 kilowatt home charger, you can cut that to 6.1%. So that's more equivalent to a level two here. And I mean, that's a crazy jump. Now, you can get closer to like 12.7% in the 2.3 kilowatt range. So in the level one range, it was the Mercedes that limited the amperage that was the outlier.
Right.
But even still, you have twice as many charging losses at that lower speed than you do at the higher speed. Partially because there's just a cost of keeping the AC to DC converter running. And doing that has its own cost. And so the longer you're doing it, the more it pays. But I thought this was really interesting because the recommendation is clear. It's like charge at as high of amperage or current as you can at your house, because that's going to give you the best. And I've seen this in action because my car, Chevy EV, is default to an 8-amp limit on a level one charge. And I don't have a driveway. So I have to run an extension cord.
Great.
I use a contractor grade electrician approved one. You shouldn't use an extension cord officially. I do not recommend it. I do it. by default, the car limits it to 8 amps, which is safe on a level one outlet. You don't know what else is on the breaker. Mine has a dedicated breaker for only that port. It has a 20 amp extension cord, so I run it at 12 amps. But when the car gets a software update, it sometimes forgets this because you can only set it at your home location to automatically do that. And so suddenly I'll come out and the car's been charging for like multiple days and it's still like not very high. And I realize it's been set to 8 amps. And the reason I bring this up is because I can literally see that impact on my
it is so
electricity bill. It's like, oh, I'm paying 25% more. I can feel it if it happens for one out of the 4 weeks in the month. And I just think that's such an important thing to know, because I think a lot of people assume charging's charging and it's a plug, so it's all going to be the same. And then that's not the case.
That's absolutely not the case. I mean, no matter which charger you charge at, like level one or level two or the public DC fast charging station, you're never going to get 100% of energy back, but there are ways you could minimize your losses. And I sort of want to highlight what these losses exactly mean. So if you're charging from your household plug, electricity will travel from that into your battery, but the onboard charger in your vehicle will sort of convert it. And in those conversion, the losses happen as heat, like extra heat gets dissipated from that. Now, if you charge at a public DC fast charging station, some of those losses happen outside of the vehicle because the dispenser itself will convert from AC to DC, and then it travels through the cables.
And you can hear the fan, right? It's producing.
And you can hear the fans.
I
mean, some of these new stations are like liquid cooled, so they don't have fans, but the older ones do. And that's the main distinction. But yeah, it's so the best way to do it is to have a level two wall box, right? That's
right.
That's yeah, how you and get 90+.
Yeah, 90+%. Yeah. Close to 95% on one of the renos in the charge was about 5.1% loss, and I think that clearly shows like you're always going to have a certain amount of loss, right? Energy moving it around is difficult. Weight better than a gas car in that regard. But yeah, I think this is so interesting because all of this talk, when we talk about LFP versus NCM, we talk about price per kilowatt hour, when we talk about charging being cheaper at level two than level one, these are places where people just still, a lot of the people hearing this will sort of know these things intuitively or they will have lived experience with them, but so many people don't. And I think it's really important to call out that, okay, here's, plug it in, don't worry about it. It's already better. But if you are going to think about it, you can really increase your odds of having a better experience. And it's a good reminder that if you have the ability in your garage to put in a level two charger, it's going to save you money on electricity over time. And it will cost some money up front. But the way I think about it is like, in 30 years, your house is going to have a level two charger. It just is. So typically things don't get cheaper over time, really. They get more expensive. It's like that 3 hours of an electrician's time now is going to be more expensive in 5 years or 10 years, whatever.
Absolutely.
So if you own the home and you want an EV, there's no reason not to just get a level two. You can totally make it work with level one. People got very mad at me in the comments when I said that my level one charging experience sucked. And again, the extension cord makes it worse.
Yeah.
But it's the quick and good version is also the cheap and efficient version. And when you have that sort of syndrome, like it's just a good investment. And I think if you can charge on level two, just that should be the best case scenario across the board. Charging level two at a hotel is better than stopping at an IANA or whatever. And the more we can get those level twos everywhere where people are leaving their cars anyways, your car primarily sits.
Absolutely.
I think it's going to just make it a lot easier and cheaper and more efficient to charge.
I also think this is one of those things where you learn as you go. And like, as we have this new wave of people have, like, early adopters have already probably figured this out, but this new wave of mass market buyers, when they're going to get into these EVs and they sort of figure out, like, try a DC public fast charging station, try level two, try level one, and eventually you're going to figure this out. Eventually you're going to be like, okay, this is the best charging method for me. Not everybody has a driveway and a garage. So for someone like me who lives in New York, you're going to end up using fast chargers a lot. But a lot of these charging companies are now also investing in like curbside charging, and you have more level two plugs everywhere. So it's going to get better over time. But I agree with what you said. Like, if you have a driveway and a charger, there's no reason for you to sort of skip on the level two charger.
And also, it's more of the people who are making choices about how to spend money and invest in infrastructure as they get lived experience, right? Like, New York right now wants to focus on expanding fast charger availability because it plugs the hole the fastest and it makes intuitive sense. You want the fastest version. But as more and more of the vehicles in the city become electrified, as more and more of that grows, you start to realize like, hey, if we want to be really cost efficient, curbside level two is actually really good. How can we make that work? Like, these are the things when we talk about, is a movie theater a good place for 400 kilowatts? And can we get regulators on board with level two over level three? These are a lot of the things that I think are going to get figured out just by people experiencing that. People who own movie theaters being like, I have an EV. I'm not going to charge it for 3 hours, right? But right now, most decision makers don't have that experience. And it's good to remember that that's just, those benefits are going to keep compounding. So with that, I want to move into our final segment, Plus and Minus, where we talk about who's up, who's down in the EV and autonomy world this week. Suvrath, who you got?
So I have a plus. I know you also have a plus, but my plus is sort of a lower level plus with a big, big asterisk.
Plus or minus or plus with a low level big asterisk. Got it.
Yeah.
We'll change the name.
So Tesla is preparing to start rolling out the Cybercab in Austin this month. So that's according to a report from The Information. And Tesla officially announced a Cybercab launch on its website yesterday. But we don't have the exact date yet.
That's the most Tesla thing ever. We're going to launch it. When?
Yeah. Create we'll tell the you hype later. First. We'll figure out the details later. Yeah. So this is the sleek steering wheel free two-door coupe with no pedals or anything that Tesla showcased a couple of years ago. It's painted in this gold color. We've been seeing these vehicles sort of doing test runs across the country. Yeah.
Have they officially said, by the way, it's only going to be gold? I don't know.
I've only seen them in gold. I don't know officially was their stance.
Like, I don't know if it's like the Cybertruck where it's just like, no, this is the only color. That would be not surprising, but interesting.
I wouldn't be surprised if some of the Tesla fans are like, let's do wraps on the Cybercabs, but I don't think they're available for sale yet. I don't know how many more launch events Tesla needs for the Cybercab, but apparently it's coming soon.
Yeah, I think, you know, the problem with Cybercab is it's never been too much of a worry about whether they're capable of producing the vehicle. It's about whether the software will be good enough to not require a steering wheel by the time they want to launch it. And that is a classic Tesla situation where we're sort of in interlocking predictions. Where it's like, well, we can't solve this until we solve this. But we said we would do this years ago and this years ago. And who knows? But I'm excited to see what they announce and what they do.
Some of this is also regulatory hurdles, right? Because a lot of states don't allow vehicles without steering wheels or human supervisors on board to sort of just do ride-hail service.
Yeah, I mean, to sell it to a customer, it's not legal for federal sale because of that. Right. Like, that is a requirement. Right. However, NHTSA recently did the first ever major waiver for a commercial service for autonomy. So they allowed Zoox to charge for rides from a car that doesn't technically meet crash standards because, again, it doesn't have required safety equipment like, you know, human operable controls.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. Maybe they could do that. I think it'll be a while. The idea of them approving it on a temporary basis, because with the Zoox deal, NHTSA is able to, the waiver, they can update it and require different things to ensure safety on a case-by-case basis. If a similar scheme is used for Tesla, which I would imagine it must be because I don't think they're going to change all the requirements quickly enough for this all to work. I could see them getting a temporary waiver, but I would imagine that would apply to Tesla-owned robo-taxis. I'm not sure if that would apply to human-owned cars. So we'll see if they end up doing a version with a steering wheel. But anyway, I'm
What's
excited to
plus?
See that. So my plus, and it is funny that we're both pluses. I feel like the last couple times I've hosted with Tim, we've also done both pluses. I try to overwhelm my instinct, which is I'm a hater at heart, and you know I'm a critic. It's fun to talk shit,
and it's easy to talk shit in this EV market.
100%. But I'm going to talk about something positive. So as you can see, I'm in a hotel right now. I'm here for the Genesis G90 EV reveal.
That's
a good one. You know, that would normally be the plus that the car has an 800-volt system. It's a flagship electric SUV with 600 horsepower, over 300 miles of range, 350 kilowatt fast charging, super luxury interior. Great, whatever. The main thing, the doors open like this. They're like the coach doors where on the Neolon, the top trim version, the ultra luxury version, it has coach style doors. So the rear doors open rearward and the front doors open frontward, but there's no pillar in the middle. So it's like a Honda Element, but kind of like a Rolls-Royce Cullinan meets a Honda Element. Because like the Rolls-Royce Cullinan, either door can open independently, but there's still a pillar in the middle.
Right.
The Element, I believe, is clamshell, so you had to open the front door to open the rear. This, you can open either one at either time, but there's no pillar in the middle. So it's completely empty in the middle.
That is so interesting.
Yeah, and then the front seats can swivel around and face the back for like a lounge style thing, which is like every car company has had that idea. They have made concept cars being like, oh, look, when things get electric, we can do this. But Genesis is doing it with a production car, which I think is so sick.
It is absolutely sick.
Yeah,
it's sick. I wonder what happens to the crash structure in terms of a side impact collision if there's no pillar in the middle.
First of all, it has airbags mounted in the roof, which it says is a roof airbag, which it says is the first ever. And I'm going to talk to them about it tonight. I'm here in San Francisco for the reveal, but the reveal is technically tonight. But we've seen the embargoed materials. This podcast comes out after the embargo, blah, 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 blah. But I'm very interested in what they say about that. What they have said is that I believe like the steel in the side structure is like 1.5 times thicker than normal. And they talk a lot about the engineering behind it. I would imagine, too, with the structural battery, that helps to some regard. But yeah, I want to talk to them about it tonight. And hopefully by the time this story or by the time this podcast is up, there will be a story up about these doors because I think it's really cool. And I thought that was a good one to end on.
Yeah, it's super cool. Swiveling seats in a production EV is definitely excited for that.
Yeah, this is someone's finally doing it. They kept promising.
And this is also the Hyundai Ioniq 9 EV9 equivalent sort of platform, right? It's the same EGMP platform EV?
No, it's EMP. So it's the new flagship platform. Yeah, and it's got the new Plius Connect software. It also doesn't have a start button, which I think is cool. Although it does
super
something
exciting.
Weird where the like PRND like gear selector when you is facing up when the car is like off and not ready to drive. And then when you get in, the car goes into ready to drive mode and like drops that thing down so that you can then put it in drive. I think the Koreans really like to have a very clear distinction between this car is ready to drive and this car is not, which is why that was why they were sticking with the power button for a while. But I think it's cool they're not doing that. The Plios Connect software is an Android automotive-based system, but now will have its own store and its own apps. I'm excited for that. I think Hyundai's software game needs to step it up. So this could be really cool. I wish I got to drive it right now, but I don't.
It's still super exciting, though.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm excited to head up to that, where I'm going to go in a little bit here. But for now, let's wrap it up. That'll do it for this week's episode. Thanks for listening to the Plugged In podcast from Inside EVs. We'll be back next Friday. Today's show was produced by Michael Perkins and brought to you by the Motorsport Network. Make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts, subscribe to the Inside EVs YouTube channel, and check out all of our latest coverage on InsideEVs.com. See you next time.